Okay, so I'm actually going to question the notion of ontological commitment a little bit. And I'm going to say that it's not as important as we perhaps thought it was. So I'm going to go over some possible analyses of the notion of ontological commitments, Quine's notion briefly, Ryo's notion, and then I'm going to argue at the end that the relation of ontological commitment is a hyper-intentional relation, and it should be cast out in terms of what we are rationally required to believe, so that's some connection to the talk yesterday, if you were attending that one, the last one, Mark's talk. Okay, so the overview, so what does ontological commitment mean? I hardly have to repeat this, but for Quine, it has to do with the values of the variables on the assumption that the theory or sentence is true. I'm going to focus mostly on sentences rather than theories, but hopefully it could be applied to theories as well. Now, Quine actually makes a mysterious remark in a different article, not in On What There Is, but in a notes on the theory of reference, because he says, well, the notion of ontological commitment belongs to the theory of reference. So what does that mean? Well, here's one thing it could mean. It could mean that the notion or relation of ontological commitment is on a par with the notion of reference. So when we say that N refers to N, maybe that's sort of similar to saying that sentence S commits us to F's. And that would mean that it's an extensional relation, where we can define an extensional relation in terms of whether it's referentially transparent in both positions. So for instance, if I say, so in the world of Superman, if I say Superman refers to Superman, and then I substitute Clark Kent for Superman, I get Superman refers to Clark Kent, and that's fine because it's obviously referentially transparent. Now, if the ontological commitment relation is referentially transparent in both positions, then we should expect the same thing. But that doesn't seem so intuitively, at least if we want our theory or notion of ontological commitment to apply to false sentences, then that seems to be give us the wrong result, because I take Santa and Odin from the Thor mythology. So Odin, the name Odin, and the name Santa, they would refer to something like the empty set, or maybe a place in a structure or something like that. And so they would possibly co-refer, right? So you should, if it's an extensional relation, you should be able to substitute one for the other. But normally, at least the way that Quine normally casts out ontological commitment, Santa is and Odin is would have different commitments, not the same commitments. Now, so, well, we might say, well, who cares about false sentences? Maybe we should just restrict our notion of ontological commitment to the true sentences. So maybe we are wrong sometimes about our theories, and actually quite often wrong about them, but ultimately it really should be applied to true sentences. There's then a different proof, which is a variation on a proof that Parsons has offered, Terence Parsons, back in the 60s, which goes roughly like this. Let's begin with the implication principle. So the implication principle says that the commitments of a sentence implications are among the commitments of the sentence itself, which seems plausible. So if you take the sentence, there are red roses, then that commits us to red roses, but it also commits us to roses, right? So it doesn't just commit us to red roses. So that's a plausible principle, especially supported by an extensional account of ontological commitment. Now, so here's another principle that's closely related to the implication principle, which has to do with the relationship between commitment and satisfaction. So we are still assuming that the ontological commitment relation is extensional. So the following principle is plausible, that the set of sentences that satisfy the predicate F is a subset of the set of sentences or entities to which their Fs is committed. It's very similar to the implication principle, except it's talking about satisfaction. So again, there are red roses would commit us to roses in addition to red roses, basically. So it's very related, it's consistent with the implication principle. But now, for the second line, so for any sentence, there are Fs, which could be that there are dogs, or there are chairs, there are humans. That, of course, entails a sentence of the form that there's something that's F or not F. And of course, the predicate F or not F, of course, is satisfied by anything. So the entities that satisfy it is a universal set, the set of everything, the full universe. But then, by our very first line here, so they are Fs or not Fs, is committed to the universal set. We can infer that because only the universal set has the universal set as a subset. And then, finally, by the implication principle, we can then infer that there are Fs is also committed to the universal set, regardless of what F is. And so basically, if ontological commitment is an extensional relation, then even a sentence, a true sentence, seemingly true sentence, there are chairs, will be committed to the universal set. So that wouldn't work. We can't just restrict our notion of ontological commitment to true sentences and take it to be an extensional relation, because we would still get counterintuitive consequences. Okay, so a more plausible suggestion for what ontological commitment means is that it's a kind of modal or intentional principle, as opposed to an extensional relation. And so Ryo has a version of the following principle, that necessarily if their Fs is true, then their Fs. And that's supposed to be a kind of conceptual or meaning analysis of there are Fs commits us to Fs. So this is a modal principle, and I'm assuming that you could also have a truth maker principle that would be similar to this one, which would basically look the same way, except you would have the relation of making true. So necessarily, if their Fs is made true or has a truth maker, then their Fs. I'm going to focus on the first one, but I think that what I'm going to say is going to apply to the truth maker principle as well. The problems with that principle are some obvious problems. So suppose that numbers do not exist and necessarily so, or pick your favorite entity that doesn't exist and necessarily so. Then consider when we plug in the sentence in this analytic sense in the modal principle, then we would get necessarily, if 2 exists is true, then 2 exists. Oh, sounds very plausible. It's vacuously true, though, since the antecedent is necessarily false. The other one will work, too. So that's the second one of the counterpossible indicatives. So actually, the strict conditionals. So necessarily, if 2 exists is true, then 2 does not exist. Well, the consequent doesn't matter, since these are vacuously true. Now, the principle, the Ryo principle, as opposed to modal principle, is supposed to go both ways. So you can go from left to right, and you can also go back from right to left. And so we can get from these two vacuously true conditionals, we can get 2 exists commits us to the number 2, very plausible. But we can also get from the second one that 2 exists doesn't commit us to the number 2, we ought to be able to move that way. But then necessarily false sentences, it's not just that they commit us to everything, it's rather that they don't have determinate ontological commitments at all. At least there's something to be said for this line of argument. It gets still worse. I'm thinking at least it does. So Ryo and other people like that might say, well, we don't really care about necessary false sentences. So maybe we shouldn't just care about true sentences and theories. Maybe we should care about possibly true sentences and theories. But what about necessarily false theories and sentences? Perhaps we can set those aside and we can just apply our principle to possibly true sentences and theories. Presumably that's not going to work either. So we have this star principle from the previous slide, namely that necessarily false sentences do not have determinate commitments. And then suppose for reductio that there are chairs, and that determinately commits us to chairs. So that seems plausible, but let's suppose that that's the case for reductio. Then you might recall the implication principle, which says that the commitments of a sentence implications are among the commitments of the sentence itself. And so by that principle, if we take a necessarily false sentence, there are pink numbers and chairs, then it follows that that should determinately commit us to chairs, but that contradicts our first premise, the star premise. That actually wasn't a premise, it was the conclusion of the previous slide. But then by reductio, their chairs does not determinately commit us to chairs, and so basically even what appears to be a true sentence do not have determinate commitments. So that seemed to disqualify the modal principle. Okay, so we might, actually before moving to other principles, let me just point out that there are some other counterintuitive or at least unintuitive consequences of the Ryo modal principle. Actually, Ryo does acknowledge some of these consequences. So for instance, suppose we have necessary entities, numbers that exist necessarily, then the consequent of the strict conditional will be satisfied. And so it doesn't matter what S is, the sentence is in the first place, so practically any sentence is committed to numbers, which seems unintuitive, possibly. Consider the sentence, John is sitting. Now, so if we go Kripkean, then in any world where that is true, John exists, and on the Kripkean theory, right? So John came from a particular zygote, or had a certain origin, which was probably a zygote, and so whatever he exists, that would be zygotes in the world, and so John is sitting would commit us to zygotes. Well, people have sort of mixed intuitions here, but I think it's slightly unintuitive. Bush Jr. and Bush Sr. exist. Well, whenever they do that, in any world where they do that, of course, one would be the father of the other, so there will be fathers, and that's sort of slightly unintuitive that just Bush Jr. and Bush Sr. exist should commit us to fathers. So these are just some other possibly unintuitive consequences of the modal principle. So what about simply taking ontological commitments just to be sort of short or a certain way of talking about our consequences in the language? Well, so we could say that S commits us to Fs, that means that there are Fs as a consequence of S. So there are a couple of problems at least with that. One problem would be that it's hard to account for the difference between the trivial nature of there are F's is a consequence of there are F's. As that's trivial, nobody would reject it. Whereas there are F's commits us to the existence of F's. I mean, that's what people are debating, right? So that doesn't seem trivial. So one is trivial, the other's not. So it doesn't seem that they could mean the same thing. We also might further worry about what the consequence relation is. Well, for Quine, of course, it would probably have to be some kind of classical consequence relation, but then we run into trouble because the classical consequence relation, well, entails everything. So if you have their numbers, then that would commit us to everything. So I'm assuming that's not a viable account of ontological commitment. What about treating ontological commitment as basic? So that's a common move. We can't find an analysis. We have the problem with the strict conditionals. And so we go basic. I think that's very plausible in many cases. So if you're a presentist and you think that the tenses are basic, that seems initially plausible. Because, I mean, we encounter tenses in ordinary language, and so presumably we have some kind of understanding, basic understanding of these terms. Do we have a basic understanding of the notion of ontological commitments? Well, that's not fully clear. I mean, it's a term of art that Quine introduced. Do we have this sufficient pre-theoretical or even sort of post-theoretical understanding of this term? Well, I don't think we do. It might be one possible way to go. But I think it would be a more convincing way if we could actually treat the notion of commit that actually occurs in ontological commitment talk the way that it's treated in ordinary language. So let's just look at a little bit of ordinary language, commitment talk in ordinary language. So what do we say in ordinary language? We say a lot of stuff. The word commit plays a role in and has various senses. So we might say John is committed to paying child support. Mary is committed to Peter. The funds are committed to a reconstruction project. Our university is committed to being international. My wife is committed to believing in me. We are committed to believing God will fulfill every promise. So these are just some of the ways that we talk about commitments in ordinary language. And so we could sort of extract some rough translations of what is committed to means. So it can mean like is obliged to, has promised to stay together with, is bound by contract to, is working towards the end, is bound by code X, where code X will be sort of the one that's contextually determined or relevant in the context. But of course, if we just go and plug in the ordinary language meanings for the commitment talk, we'll get nonsense, right? So that's not going to work. Santa is makes us obliged to Santa. Nonsense. Santa is made us promise to stay together with Santa. Santa is binds us by contract to Santa. Santa is makes us work towards the ends. Santa is binds us by codex to Santa. Of course, that's not going to work. So I'm suggesting that if we are sort of trying to spell out this account in terms of ordinary language, the ordinary language meaning of commit, then perhaps what we are doing, and when we talk about sentences or theories being committed to entities, perhaps we are really talking sort of elliptically. And here by ellipsis, I'm not going to mean ellipsis in a syntactic sense. That would be silly. Is sort of in an utterance sense. So we might say Santa Claus is committed to the existence commits us to the existence of Santa Claus. And then one way of filling in that, perhaps what we could mean would be that accepting Santa Claus commits us to believing in the existence of Santa Claus, or accepting Santa Claus requires us by code X to believe that Santa Claus exists. That would be one of the ordinary meanings that would fit in, perhaps. And then we might ask, well, which code would be relevant here? well, we're talking about acceptances. I'll get back to what that notion might mean. But we're also talking about belief. And so the relevant code seems to be that of rationality. So that would be one possible way of filling it in terms of the ordinary language meanings. So you might look at this as a way of treating ontological commitment as basic, rather than as an analysis, even though I might refer to it as an analysis. Acceptance, here I just have chosen to focus on a particular notion of acceptance, which is different from Stolnicker's and von Frassen's notion, but it's one that would entail belief. So it's sort of a kind of sincere acceptance. And it would be occurring rather than standing, so belief can be tacit or standing, whereas acceptance presumably is not. It's probably occurrence, so one can fail to accept a sentence that one believes. Now, ultimately, I think that we probably want to be pluralist about the primary bearers of ontological commitments. So it's not just acceptances of sentences that could ultimately carry commitments. So different speech acts and intentional acts with a T can carry commitments. So we could also at least imagine that an assertion of, so a genuine assertion of Santa is, would require us perhaps by the rules of assertion to assent to the sentence that Santa is. We can also imagine that presupposing that Santa is would require us by the rules of presupposition to assent to Santa is. But I'll just focus on acceptance. So then the let's analysis here, which you might just take to be a sort of an explication of the ordinary language meaning of the word commits would be something like this. So S commits us to S. Well, so at least one possible meaning of that would be accepting. So it's an acceptance of the sentence S that rationally requires us to believe that there are Fs. And, well, we might debate how to spell this out, the analyst sans here. One possible way would be in terms of a strict conditional, so necessarily if we accept S, then we are rationally required to believe that there are Fs that may turn out to be problematic. Okay, some objections and then some consequences after that. Okay, so we might worry. So the top line is just basically the necessary conditional that necessarily if we accept S, then we are rationally required to believe that there are Fs, and that would be sort of a meaning analysis of that the sentence S commits us to Fs. Now, of course, if the antecedent of the strict conditional could be necessarily false, then we would run into some of the same problems as the other criteria. So could there be unacceptable sentences? Perhaps a more like sentence, like A, it's raining, but I do not accept it's raining. It would be very odd to accept this sentence. And so we might worry that it's unacceptable, but if it's unacceptable, then again we have these the false antecedent of the strict conditional, and so we run into some of the same problems as the earlier notions or analyses of ontological commitment. So that would be a problem. Now, so here's one reply to that. Acceptance is a psychological notion, so it may be very odd to accept the A sentence, the more like sentence, but it's a psychological notion, acceptance, and so it seems that there's nothing sort of, there's no logical contradiction in actually accepting this sentence. It's really psychological and very strange if people do it, but. So we wouldn't get the result where the antecedent of the strict conditional would be necessarily false. A further worry, which I won't really deal with because, I mean, that could be debated, is what about an infinitely long sentence? Is that unacceptable? Is there something that sort of logically will rule out that we can have infinitely long sentences that we could sort of utter and accept as we go along, that might be a possible problem. A quick other objection. So that goes the other way. Again, the first line is just the analytic sense of the analysis. So suppose there's some things that we are rationally required to believe no matter what, or under some very weak conditions. So in particular, suppose that if I accept a sentence, suppose there's a world, I accept the sentence that 2 plus 2 is 4. Well, then at least I have some minimal cognitive capacities if I can accept the sentence like that. And so you might think that I should, just by my acceptance of that sentence, I am rationally required to believe that my mind exists. Well, why? Well, because it seems that if I have some cognitive abilities, one might argue, I should just accept certain things that seem obvious to me that I have so that I can introspect and find out that my mind exists. And so perhaps that's something that I'm rationally required to do whenever I accept that 2 plus 2 is 4. And so again, we would run into trouble because then we would have the analytic sense would be satisfied no matter what S is. So 2 plus 2 is 4 would commit us to the existence of my mind, which seems unintuitive. Basically, again, I think that we don't need a strict notion of rationality, and so we can simply reject that we are rationally required to believe that we have minds in any world where we accept sentences. So it would take the other things that would have to be in place. We would have to possess the concept of mind and so on. So one can suggest that it's a weaker notion of rationality that would be involved in this. Okay, so one more objection. Basically, I mean, when we're talking about belief context, of course, the traditional problems of belief will arise. And one problem, of course, for, say, mostly Russellian accounts of belief context and propositions and so on, will be that of empty names. But we can easily get empty names, right? Because it may be that we are talking about, well, what does the sentence 8 is an even number commit us to? Well, so accepting it, so suppose Mary accepts it, well, then Mary is rationally required to believe that 8 exists. But if 8 does not exist, then what does 8 refer to? So this is sort of introducing the range of standard problems when talking about belief. And there are some standard notions or solutions that one can invoke to this problem. One would be Fregeanism. Here we would posit that singular terms like 8 would undergo a reference shift in the scope of belief. So 8 really wouldn't refer to 8 when it's embedded under belief. It would refer to the concept of 8, or the sense of 8. Russellianism is not going to, in a simple, naive version, is not going to work if we want to preserve our intuitions about ontological commitments, because the very standard strategy in philosophy of language, endorsed by David Brown, Nathan Salmon, Scott Soames, and a bunch of other people, is to go gabby on these cases where you have non-referring terms. And so Brown, for instance, suggests that, well, if we have 8 occurring under belief, well, then 8 will just still refer to either an empty slot in a structure or the empty set. We can't endorse that because then some of our intuitions will once again be violated that we violated earlier on the extensional accounts. So, for instance, 8 exists. I'm assuming that 8 still doesn't exist necessarily. So 8 exists and Santa exists because 8 and Santa do not exist. Well, what kinds of commitments do they incur? Well, they incur the same kinds of commitments on this Russellian strategy. because they're just referring to gappy contents. So one might then, once again, go Frege-ian, which is the hidden indexical theory is sort of a Frege-ian move, because they would invoke, or could be a Frege-ian move anyway, because they would invoke, again, a reference, a sort of implicit reference in belief reports to something like propositional guises or senses. The important thing is that that leads to the hyper-intentionality of ontological commitments. Once you have belief is a hyper-intentional operator, and once you have belief involved in an analysis of ontological commitment, it's natural to expect that you would get hyper-intentionality. But you can also get the argument off the ground without talking about beliefs. So let's just define hyper-intentionality. So if you have an operator O, and you have two sentences, and they're necessarily equivalent, and so you plug in O in front of each of the sentences, and the result of doing that will not be necessarily equivalent. That's what it is to be hyperintentional for an operator. So we can extend that to ontological commitments. If we extend that to ontological commitment, we might say something like this. Well, whenever you have two expressions, they're necessarily coextensional, and still you can't substitute one for the other in a sentence that talks about ontological commitments. If that's the case, then ontological commitment would be a hyperintentional relation. So naturally, of course, it will be a hyperintentional relation, because so here's an example. So 8 and 9 are necessarily coextensional. But 8 exists, commits us to 8. It does not commit us to 9. Again, this is on the assumption that there are no numbers. Just by that simple example, we would actually get ontological commitment to be hyperintentional. And we could pick other examples. If you don't like these ones, we could talk about pink numbers exist. There are pink numbers and there are orange numbers, which at least some people might think that they should have different commitments. Okay, so just a quick summary here. So it's the way we talk. We say that the ontological commitment relation is a relation between a sentence and a class of things, or a sentence and an object. And what I'm suggesting is, well, that's not quite right. It should be a relation between an intentional act or speech act and a hyperintention, which is something like a narrow concept or a sense. Okay, so how wide-ranging is this hyperintentionality of the ontological commitment relation? So Hesperus exists. Well, that commits us to the existence of Hesperus. It requires us to believe that Hesperus exists. The question then arises, what about phosphorus? Well, Hesperus exists. Should that commit us to phosphorus exists? Should be, second line should be Hesperus exists. We might imagine a theory, actually two theories in ancient Greece. So we would have one theory talking about Hesperus and its properties as an evening star, and we would have another theory talking about phosphorus as the morning star instantiating certain properties. And we might want those two theories to have different ontological commitments, in which case the hyperintentionality of the operator would be quite wide-ranging. Ultimately, if this explication that we just talked about is correct, it will come down to whether we should accept a certain closure principle for rational, what you're rationally required to believe. So are you rationally required to believe all consequences of what you are rationally required to believe? We saw yesterday that Mark Cullivan suggested that maybe we are actually committed to that, but we should give up classical logic and I was trying to push for her that, well, maybe we shouldn't accept this strong closure principle. I'm not going to take a stance on this, but I'm just going to say that if we deny the closure principle, then these terms won't necessarily be intersubstitutable. So ontological commitment will be relative, agent relative, because it will depend on, or perhaps society relative, would depend on what people actually, the sort of overall doxastic state of the person, the agent. We might also take another line if we think this is too radical. We could take another line and say, well, actually, yes, the closure principle holds, in which case ontological commitment could still be agent neutral. Okay, I'm actually close to being done. Okay, so some consequences of it. It turned out, like by coincidence, actually, that's actually some close connection between Mark's talk yesterday and this talk. So I actually cut out one slide, which was hopelessly naive compared to Mark's elaborate coverage of this. But I had a slide on inconsistent sentences. I cut that out, but there's some other interesting consequences, since we've already seen Mark's line on this. So normally, when you invoke substitutional quantification, you're trying to avoid ontological commitments, because ontological commitment is supposed to be a substantial notion. So you can say, well, if you have a truth in the language, so as soon as example with Mickey Mouse is a fictional mouse that talks, you can infer from that, using substitutional quantifiers, that that there are fictional mice that talk. And we don't get, normally, or at least that's what he's suggesting, we don't get ontological commitments from this. We're not committed to talking mice. Now, on the current approach, since this is not a substantial notion, if we go with this line of thinking about ontological commitment, well, what does it mean to say that we're committed to fictional mice, or that there are fictional mice that talk commits us to fictional mice? Well, it just means that accepting the sentence, really accepting, sincerely accepting the sentence, means that we ought to believe that there are fictional mice that talk. Or if you're just presupposing it, so suppose you're presupposing that there are fictional mice that talk, then you ought to believe it, but perhaps by the rules of presupposition, that there are fictional mice that talk, or maybe you ought to just to assent to it. But that means that, so standardly taken, well, Quine sort of seemed to think that the objectual quantification implies ontological commitments, substitutional quantification does not. We do not get that difference. So it's neutral. It does not, to say that a sentence is ontologically committed to something will not tell us anything about the quantifiers. It's a very sort of innocent way of speaking. The same will go for objectual quantification with a substitutional meta-language. This is again Jody Asuni's approach to objectual quantification, because he says, well, there's still the option. When we have objectual quantification, we spell it out in terms of a domain, a range of the variables, but we use there is in the meta-language. And so we could say, well, at the object language, we'll spell it out this way, objectually. But at the level of the meta language, we will spell it out in a non-objectual way, perhaps substitutional, perhaps some other related approach. And Jody Asuni says, oh, so we can avoid commitment that way. And again, on this very innocent way of construing ontological commitment, we do not avoid ontological commitment simply because accepting a sentence or asserting a sentence just requires us to believe or assent to certain things. Two more consequences and then I'm done. So that's also, this is related to what Jonathan was talking about yesterday, though this particular account is from Russ Cameron at Leeds and Robbie Williams at Leeds. They think that you can, if you construe ontological commitments as truth maker, in terms of truth makers, then you don't have to paraphrase, and you can say that there are chairs is made true by collections of atoms. Basically, your ontological commitments of the sentence will be in terms of its truth makers, so you don't have to paraphrase away. You can still be literally assert the sentence. So the sentence does not commit you to chairs, according to them. It only commits you to atoms. Again, if I'm right about this way of explicating ontological commitment, this won't work because it's very innocent to talk about ontological commitment. Last one, consequence. This is again Jody Assoni and others. Some people think, well, to say that there is not ontologically committing. In order to have something that's ontologically committing, we need something like an existence predicate. And that doesn't have to be existence, first order existence. It can be concreteness, ontological independence, present, or whatever. So the presentist might say, yeah, we can talk about past objects. Yeah, they're past objects. But they're not present. So to really exist is to be so quantifier exists and to be present, for instance. And the nominalists and so on can adopt this principle. And I'm going to say, well, again, they're trying to avoid ontological commitment. Well, this is rather innocent to talk about ontological commitment, so this, again, will not work, at least not as formulated. Okay, so conclusion, very quickly, basically. I think that ontological commitments, given the failures of many of the ways to explicate ontological commitment, should be understood in terms of what we are rationally required to believe. I think there's textual evidence in Quine for doing it this way, which I haven't been able to go into. On this particular way of construing it, ontological commitment would be a relation between an intentional act and a hyper intention. And at the very end, as we saw, well, to say that we ontologically committed to something is rather cheap and neutral on sort of the nature of the quantifiers. That's it.
There being F's, but rather your theory commits you to there being the things that play the F role in your theory. whatever they claim.
That would be an interesting consequence. Let me just say that of course the possible world interpretation of propositions probably will not work, because there was this independent way of showing that the ontological commitment relation is hyperintentional, and so you would need it to be a relation to something like a sense, or so you could get the substitution failure from that. Whereas if you have a possible world interpretation of a proposition, you wouldn't get substitution failure. That would be more like the resilient account. That wouldn't work. That would give us some counterintuitive consequences. But the second part of what you said, I think that's an interesting suggestion. Yeah, I mean, I would be all in favor of that actually, but maybe even more relative to agent framework. The agents framework was not what you were suggesting. So I don't think we could. It would not be as radical as to include possible worlds in the propositions, but I think it would be, it would be worth thinking about. Actually, I would like that.
So the possible worlds was just an illustration. Maybe that was misleading. I wasn't.
Right. So, yeah, that was why I was sort of dividing up into.
Or just as you say, there are numbers. So that's just a different. I have a theory of what numbers are, and I actually claim it's analytic. And then are you committed to there being those whatever platonic?
Right. So, no, that would be. That's interesting. That would be, I absolutely like that.
You. I want to ask you what the differences are between your approach and another approach, I would suggest.
Okay.
The other approach, so motivation comes from the observation that many of these issues of commitment and rationality that you're talking about are not specifically issues about ontological commitment. They're much more general issues about theoretical commitment. So when does accepting S commit us to T?
Yeah.
So the more general approach would say, well, let's deal with that issue first. And maybe the right answer is goes in terms of rationality and so on. But then this approach I'm suggesting says, well, for the ontological case, we just need to consider the case in which the second proposition or sentence is of the form there are X's or something of that form. So it just falls out as a special case of the general theory, invoking the Quinean principle that there's, as it were, there's nothing more than ontological questions than questions of what there is.
Right. No, so
how different would that be from?
So as I'm understanding you, so you would start what I ended with. So you get like all these the range of criteria, so presupposing and accepting, and then is your proposal that you would pick one of those to be the candidate for ontological commitment, or would you even want to have the sentence to be the primary bearer of ontological commitment?
My suggestion was, you forget all about the ontological bit, just think about the more general issue of theoretical commitment.
Yeah, so which of the ones is...
When does accepting S commit us to T?
Yes.
Were those things are both sort of sentential or propositional? Okay, so to deal with that issue first, and then bringing the ontology in the way that Quine suggests by treating the issue about ontological commitment as simply the issue as theoretical commitment to statements of the form there are X's, existentially quantified statements.
Right. I'm not seeing that as inconsistent with this. So you're starting out by saying, well, when are you accepting a certain theory, right? And then what follows from that?
Yeah.
And then you restrict the approach to just those sentences that would be quantified in his sense. I think that would be an interesting way to go. That's a good suggestion. I think ultimately it wouldn't lead us to the kind of substantial. So it wouldn't have the result that objectual quantification implies ontological commitment, whereas substitutional quantification does not. I still think I would get that consequence that we would have a certain neutrality in terms of talking about ontological commitment, because the quantifier. The approach that I'm suggesting, you can interpret the quantifiers whichever way you like, and you would still get.
I think that might not be right. It seemed to me the attraction of the approach was that it was sort of cleaner because it was explicit about the fact that many of the issues we were discussing were issues about, as it were, commitment in general.
Right.
Accepting something else.
And then you can sort of single down on one. I think I would like that as a special case. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Just a question I will avoid to myself. So I have the really strong intuition that ontological commitment is supposed to be existential. So when the sentence commits us to the evening star, it also thereby has committed us to the morning star. So
that's consistent with the intentional too. Intentional account. But let's go with yours. Extensional. Yeah.
But maybe we can come back to that afterwards. So here's a variant on what you propose that sounds to me appealing and will produce the result that I want to produce. So it will be something like accepting there is an X such that X is F involves committing to F's. Now let me explain what involves means and what commitment to means. So involves is something like X involves Y if Y is a component of X. So for example, when we say being glad that P involves believing that P. You cannot be glad that P without believing that P. So that there's a sense in which believing that P is a component of being glad that P. And so now I want to say that committing to F's is a component in the same sense of accepting that accepting there is an X such that X is F. Now, what is committing to? I'm thinking of it as a sui generis attitude, psychological attitude.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like believing in, which is different from believing that, right? We say believing in God, believing in truth.
Okay. Yeah.
That's it's a psychological attitude, but it's not like believing that. It's a bit mysterious what exactly believing in is. But committing to will be something like believing in, but since it's a technical term and we introduce it into the language and we decide just how it will behave, we determine that it will behave such that it does allow substitution. There won't be failure of substitution. So believing in God does not entail believing in Jimmy's favorite divinity. Jimmy's favorite whatever.
Right, because belief is
hyper-intentional. Believing in is hyper-intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
But we will define committed to such that if someone is committed to God, then someone is also committed to Jimmy's favorite divinity.
Mm.
So it will be like believing in star. It's just something, a verb that we're introducing into augmented English. And now we're saying, this is what ontological commitment is. Accepting there is an X such that X is F involves committing to, or believing in star is a component of accepting. That's this will produce the result that ontological commitment is
extensional. Yeah.
And it's kind of sort of intuitive to me.
That does sound intuitive to you. To me, but then there are the problems. I mean, once you apply it to ontological commitment talk, you would get some of the consequences that I was trying to outline at the beginning. I'm thinking maybe there's a way to avoid them, but at least sort of taking it at face value, it looks like you would get some of the possibly counterintuitive consequences. So you might not. So the Odin exists and Santa exists. To you, that might sound fine that they have the same commitments.
Right.
It's less. I mean, it's more odd if I had a longer proof where which had as a conclusion there might be maybe you can reject the premise in that proof, but if the proof is sound, it has as a conclusion that the sentence "there are chairs" will commit us to the universal set, the set of everything.
Oh, because of the implication principle.
Yeah, so you would have to deny that.
Right. Okay, so can you put on the slide on the implication principle? Because I kind of...
Yeah,
how
do we do this?
Whoa.
It was far too
far. It was kind of...
There,
yes,
right.
There you go. It was kind of, I don't know, there was something... I had mixed feelings about it.
I do have, let me just add before you start to convey your mixed feelings. My mixed feelings are that is talking about the implications. I would want to restrict it. But I think that a version of that principle would work, where implications would not be just any other old implication, maybe a relevant implication or something. So in the case I considered with the red roses and roses, those would be relevant implications. But yes. but let me hear what yours are.
So suppose I deny this. I deny the implication principle.
Yeah, then you couldn't get that argument off the ground.
Sorry, which?
Yeah, you would have blocked the argument. Yeah, if you deny it.
Right. Now, how do I deny it plausibly? That's the question. So suppose I say that there are red roses commits us to red roses. It also commits us to roses. Now, the reason it commits us to roses is not that it entails there are roses. That is not the reason why it commits us to roses. It commits us to roses because the state of affairs, not the sentence, not the proposition, the state of affairs of there being roses is necessitated by the state of affairs of there being red roses. Sorry. The state of affairs of there being roses is necessitated by the state of affairs of there being red roses. Or maybe just because roses are, being a rose is a determinable of which being a red rose is a determinant. So something like that, the principle will be, it will commit us to all these other things, but not because of its implications, but because of the necessitation relations between the thing, the only thing that it immediately commits us to, and other things. Okay, that wasn't very well put at all.
I think that might be ways to... So the state of affairs one, where one state of affairs necessitates another state of affairs, I'm worried that that's just another way of formulating it. I would have to think about whether the proof would go through on that one, but it may just be because it's very, very similar to saying...
Right. The key is to say that there are red roses commits us to roses, but it doesn't commit us to roses because it implies there are roses.
Right.
So there's some other story to tell.
Yeah. In that case, of course, I mean, one would have to see if what that could be a similar proof. I mean, so obviously the proof as stated will be blocked. Yeah. So it's a good suggestion maybe just to look at whether that would be other. It would have to be consistent, of course, with the extensional approach. So you can't have all these fancy. Actually, the principle I was suggesting with the relevant implications might not even be a candidate because the extensional approach sort of puts some constraints on the kinds of principles that that you could endorse. But some of the your suggestions might work. And so the question is whether there then is another proof. That would be worth taking into consideration, the alternatives to that, or ways of blocking the implication principle, yeah.
Yes. So that's, maybe that's the key. If you want to save the extensionalism about, you have to deny the implication principle. That seems to be...
And plus, you would also have to deviate quite a bit from at least some of the most famous quotes in Quine's, and there is where he says, so one of the quotes he says... Pegasus is commits us to an ontology containing Pegasus and he talks about numbers and so on. That's one of the famous quotes. And anyway, so he explicitly seems to think that when we have false sentences, that can have different kinds of commitments. That may again just be a way that he's sort of speaking loosely, but you do have some bullets to bite if you go for the extensional approach.
Yeah, that sounds right.
But other than that, I think it's the most promising one, only because that is sort of what people take it to be when they really go in and do metaphysics. They don't care about all the other cases.
Right.
They just care about they want an answer to the question what exists,
right.
And so they don't care about the false sentences. Ultimately, they just care about the true ones.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I'm now thinking. Sorry.
I just want to ask a question about object and substitution quantification. It's a genuine request for help. I've never read the paper that I'm going to refer to, so I don't know that what I think it says, it does say, but there's a paper by Henkin, which it seems to me blurs the distinction between that you all have been drawing. And basically, if you introduce a constant into a formalization, into a logical system, then you can always suppose that it denotes itself. And in connection with this, people have referred to practices in classical geometry, in Euclidean geometry, and a process known as ecthesis. So my question is just, maybe the distinction between the two sorts of quantification isn't quite as straightforward as has been supposed.
No, I think that's right. I think that that's not just objectual quantification and substitutional quantification. In fact, I was referring to Jody Ozoni's approach, where he takes objectual quantification at the object language, but the standard way of spelling out objectual quantification will involve there is in the meta language. And he says, well, to get genuine objectual quantification, we need to get objectual quantification all the way up, right? So, if you have substitutional quantification, he says, in the meta language, you don't have the commitments that you would think you have from from objectual quantification. I think ultimately that the meta language cannot be interpreted as substitutional quantification. And so I'm agreeing with you, though your particular example is very interesting too, but I'm agreeing with you so that there must be non-objectual kinds of quantification which are not substitutional. I don't know what they look like, but that may be a suggestion, or at least one possible case. Yeah.
This is just a follow up on the extensionality issue. It seemed to me that the proof, but maybe I just missed something, that we are committed by their chairs to there being the universal set didn't work, because it assumed that the sentence "there are roses" commits us to the set of all things that are roses, but I don't see why that would be so.
There are red roses, you mean, commits us to
the set, so on the next slide, I think you said, there are roses, commits us to there being the set of all roses, to all actual roses like existing, but it seems to me that the sentence, yeah, it's the first principle here.
Yeah, so there are red roses, commits us to red roses and to roses. Is that what you want?
Right, uh-huh. The point is the first sentence, the set of entities that satisfy FX, no, where do you...
Yeah, the set of sentences that satisfy FX is a subset of the set of entities.
Right, that's yep. That's the sentence which I would like to deny. So suppose you accept there are roses, there is an X, FX. This seems to be commits you to accepting that there is at least one rose. It doesn't entail that you have to believe that all the things that are roses, the actual set of entities that satisfy their roses, that you have to believe that all those things exist. You have to believe that there is at least one rose.
Right.
On the second step, if you accept there is an X FX or not FX, you have to believe that there is at least one thing, because everything will be FX on one. So you're committed by the implication thesis to there being at least one thing.
That's right.
But that's not bad. I mean, if you say there are chairs, of course you're committed to there being at least one thing. You're not committed, I think, to there being the universal set of all actual things.
Well, but it goes through satisfaction. So I agree with everything you just said. But when you're talking about satisfaction, so the set of entities that actually satisfy, to talk about satisfaction is like talking about extension or denotation, right? So we're asking about the predicate FX, what's the extension of that? Well, that will be the set. So if F is red roses, or let's say that F is roses, then the extension of that will be the whole class of roses. And so if you do accept the first premise, maybe you're denying the first premise, but if you do accept the first premise...
What is the first premise?
I meant the first, the top.
Which is not really a premise. But. Yeah. The first sentence seems clearly false to me. It should be superset, not subset.
It should be the superset?
Yeah.
Rather than subset.
Or maybe, I'm not sure actually if it's either. But, so if I accept the sentence, there are roses, I'm not thereby committed to accepting the existence of all the actual things that are roses, I might actually believe that there are no roses, whatever, in Africa.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I might disbelieve in some of the actual roses. It doesn't seem to me that just by accepting there are roses, I accept the existence of roses in Africa, which are part of the set of roses.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that the first sentence here isn't obvious.
Yeah, that's an interesting objection to this one. So, there's a general feeling though. This is sort of a new suggestion from the literature. If you just look at how people speak in the literature, of course you would say that there are roses will commit you to roses, but you're saying that's not that doesn't imply that it's a whole set of roses. So you're saying it just implies that it's that there's at least one rose. So that would be an interesting. But of course, you're just saying that, right? So it wouldn't be a subset. So it would go the other way around.
Right.
Something like the set of instances to which their f's is committed is a subset of the set of instances that satisfy f(x). Now you can get a proof running if you reverse it. Instead of saying that any sentence this is an x fx, this is the next line, entails a sentence of the form something is f or not f, you could say that any such sentence is entailed by a sentence of the form that is an x such that fx and not fx. And then what you can get is, of course, then you have a kind of contradiction embedded under, or a contradictory predicate embedded under an existential quantifier. That sets, so the set of instances that satisfy the contradictory predicates will be the empty set. And from that, you can then get to that the contradictory existential sentence is committed to the empty set, and then by the last line and your first suggestion, you can get then that there are chairs is committed to the empty set.
But now you use the converse of the implication.
I was using the all I did was I was actually still using implication, but
no,
I was using the converse of your first principle.
But you also moved from there is an x fx to there is an x fx and not fx.
Which one is
which that? Which implies it. But surely you can't move from any sentence to, so I'm surely not committed by accepting a sentence to accepting any sentence from which that sentence follows.
Oh, so you're applying you're rejecting the implication principle now.
No, you move from I accept there is an x fx to then we in the second step to there is an x fx and not fx.
Oh, but I'm not saying that there is an f entails that. I'm saying the other way around.
Other way around is not legitimate. That's the converse of it.
Oh, but that step doesn't rely on the implication principle. This step just says that in sheer logic, there is something that's both f and not f entails that there is something that's f. And then from that we can move to saying that the set of entities that satisfy the contradictory predicates is the empty set. And then the next line would be the contradictory existential sentence is committed to the universal sets, and then by the implication principle, if you don't deny that, we get that there are chairs is committed to the empty set.
No, because there is an x fx doesn't imply there is an x fx and not fx.
No, it doesn't imply that. We don't need that. You need the other way around. You need that there is something that's f and not f implies there are f's.
Well, maybe you can resolve this.
I can write it out then.
Let me put a finger on that same point, or on the same slide at least. You've got it, the 1, 2, 3 on the fourth line. You say that the existence of x's which are either fx or either f or not f is committed to a universal set. Does that mean the same thing? And I'm not sure that it does. Does it mean the same thing, or would it be another way of interpreting that, to say that making that statement, there are either f's or not f's,
I'm actually committed to another concept, which is there is something rather than nothing. I'm not actually committed to a universal set of everything there is, because I haven't nominated all the G's and H's and I's and J's.
Yeah.
I'm not committed to anything else that exists.
Yeah.
Just by saying that there are either F's or not F's is actually just to say something about the backward E. It's just to say that to say that something exists actually says that there is something rather than nothing. My commitment is not to a universal set of all things.
It's the universal
notion of the fact that there is something wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree that's a natural interpretation of it, but this was an inference from the first premise. And so assuming, Wolfgang may be right about his rejection of the first premise, but let's suppose that he's not. Let's suppose the first premise is right. Then that would follow. So that was the idea. So if the first premise is right, this follows, regardless of your independent intuitions about that line. So I can agree with you that's my intuitions about it, which presumably would mean that we should agree with Wolfgang that we should reject the first.
Yes, I think I'm also rejecting the first premise.
Yes. Yeah. So it's possible. I have to think about that, but we'll write it out afterwards. But I'm tempted to think that that's then if you reverse it, if you then commit yourself to the reverse principle, I think that's a different proof that's similar with involving the empty set that would give us the same counterintuitive result. But we'll write it up afterwards.
Any other question? Well, let's thank Britt.
I'm going to go to the next one.